welcome to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in today for the Melody Cederstrom. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political events of the day. Today is Thursday, February 11th, 2021. Hello, Todd. Thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with the market report. How about that? Looking at the precious metal markets, a down day today, apparently pressured by short-term futures sellers. Gold was is down about $18.60 in the New York spot aftermarket, $18.26. Silver down 4 cents at $27.07. Platinum down $3 at $12.42. Palladium down $19 at $24.25. Oil today had a down day as well, down 1.25%, 75 cents a barrel to $57.93. In the Treasury market, we see the 10-year yield up again ever so slightly, 0.01% to 1.162% yield. The 5 and 30 years were also up a tad, 2-year down a tad, 3-month unchanged. In the ever so volatile paper markets, most international markets up, ranging from 0.5% to a little over 1% in Shanghai. Here in the U.S., 2 out of 3 also up. NASDAQ up 53.24 to 14,025 and change. Dow Jones down, the only U.S. market down today, $7.50 at 31,430. And the broad market S&P 500 up $6 and change to 3,916. Fixed volatility index, 2120. That's down about 3.5%. And the U.S. dollar index up, 0.04% to 90.41, still holding on ever so desperately to that $90-ish level. And I think that's about it for today's market report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. On the news front, and there's a lot of it, we're seeing that from the Treasury Department today that the federal budget deficit widened in January to about 5 times the year earlier level, reflecting spending on stimulus and relief payments approved by Congress in December. Deficit increased to $162.8 billion last month, up a tad from $32.6 billion in January 2020, according to the monthly Treasury report. In the first 4 months of the fiscal year that began in October, fiscal year 2021, deficit amounted to $736 billion, just shy of that, a record for the period, compared with $389 billion a year earlier, just before the pandemic began. Today's report, the first to include the effects of the $900 billion aid package approved in late December, highlights the extent of federal aid deployed to combat the recession. At the same time, the government's interest rate payments on debt have actually shrunk during the current fiscal year due to the plunge in borrowing costs from near zero interest rates. Democrats are now emphasizing that as they work to push through an additional $1.9 trillion in stimulus and relief aimed at consumer and business relief as the pandemic drags on. Government spending in January jumped over 35%, while revenues, taxes, and otherwise increased just 3.3% from a year ago, with outlays driven by government support, including $600 stimulus payments for Americans. Now, the budget deficit this year, which ends on September 30th, may exceed the 2020 gap of about $3.1 trillion if the latest fiscal aid package is passed. That's according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. That's a nonpartisan group, a think tank in Washington. Now, not counting, well, I guess counting this year, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that budget deficits will average $1.2 trillion per year over the next 10 years under the 2021 budget passed by the Senate, with the debt held by the public rising to $41 trillion by the end of 2030. Boy, it's good to be king and queen in the District of Columbia, ladies and gentlemen. Now, first-time claims for unemployment insurance were 793,000 last week, even as declining COVID infections provided little relief for the jobs market. The total for the week ended February 6th was above economists' forecasts of 760,000, but a slight decrease from the previous week's upwardly revised total of 812,000. This extended pandemic era has provided a long struggle for the job market to get back to its previous level. Non-farm payrolls increased by just 49,000 in January, while the headline unemployment rate fell to 6.3%, primarily due to decline in the labor force, most of them women. Continuing claims for benefits, which run a week behind the weekly number, also declined, falling 145,000, but still at 4.5 million, still the lowest total since the end of March last year. However, the total of those receiving benefits across all programs jumped to 20.4 million. That was due to a surge in filings for two other pandemic compensation programs for those who wouldn't otherwise receive benefits and for those whose regular benefits have run out. That's the extended program. Enrollment under the special pandemic programs rose by nearly 2.7 million for the weekend of January 23rd. The programs had expired the day after Christmas, but were temporarily renewed by Congress at the end of the year. Paperwork issues resulted in delays for several states, such as Ohio, which saw an increase of more than 90,000 claims there last week, according to unadjusted data. The new legislation provides benefits of $300 above what recipients normally would get through, I believe, it's March 15th. And California also saw a notable increase with a little over 23,000 new claims. Several states saw notable declines, like Florida, 51,500, New York, roughly 20,000, and Maryland, about 19,800. Gus Faucher, who's chief economist at PNC Financial, said job growth will remain soft for the next few months as the nation continues to struggle with the pandemic. More than 10 million workers are still unemployed, despite more than 12.5 million jobs reclaimed since the worst of the pandemic in March and April. I should say the worst so far. Let's hope it is, or was. Yeah, Fed Chair Jerome Powell, good old Jay, told elites at the New York Economic Club yesterday that the jobs picture remains a long way from where it needs to be. He added that the Fed's committed to keeping interest rates low until substantially more progress on the labor market happens. Despite the surprising speed of recovery early on, I should say rebound, we are still very far from a strong labor market whose benefits are broadly shared. Those are Powell's words. After rising to 14.8% in April last year, the government's U3 unemployment rate has fallen steadily, reaching, as I mentioned earlier, reported 6.3% in January. But published unemployment rates long have dramatically understated the deterioration in the labor market. Most importantly, the pandemic has led to the largest 12-month decline in labor force participation in over 70 years. That's a lot of discouraged workers, ladies and gentlemen. Fear of the virus and the closing of tens of thousands of businesses, resulting in the disappearance of employment opportunities in the sectors most affected by it, like restaurants, hotels, and entertainment venues, have led thousands, literally, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in fact, simply withdraw from the workforce. They've stopped looking for a job. And at the same time, virtual schooling has forced many parents to leave the workforce, particularly women, to provide all day daycare for their children. All told, almost 5 million people say the pandemic has prevented them from looking for work in January. In addition, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that many unemployed individuals have simply been misclassified as employed. And here's the point. Even good old Jay Powell said yesterday that counting those who've left the workforce since last February as unemployed would boost the unemployment rate close to 10% in January. In fact, we believe the figure is closer to 12. That's essentially the government's U6 unemployment rate, which counts short-term discouraged workers as well as those working part-time, even though they want to be working full-time. Now, that's significant. Powell, a major establishment figure, making the admission, who, along with his institutional colleagues and the media, chronically underreported the government's unemployment and inflation figures. Unfortunately, even those grim statistics understate the decline in labor market conditions for most economically vulnerable Americans. The decline in employment for workers in the top 25% of wage earners has been only 4%, while the decline for workers in the bottom quartile has been more than four times greater, a staggering 17%. The past few months, improvement in labor market conditions stalled as the rate of COVID infections began to sharply increase again. Now that they're leveling off again, perhaps we'll see another turnaround. At the same time, however, a lot more places seem to be opening up. So we'll see what happens. But in particular, jobs in the leisure and hospitality sector dropped over 500,000 in December and another 61,000 in January. Now, here's the thing. Given the number of people who've lost their jobs and the likelihood that some will struggle to find work in the post-pandemic economy, achieving and sustaining maximum or full or natural employment will require more than supportive monetary policy. In fact, it's done little to date. It will require a society-wide, a country-wide, a nationwide, a worldwide commitment with contributions from across government and the private sector. The potential benefits of investing in our nation's workforce are just simply immense. I mean, more inflation doesn't promote jobs. If anything, it it's a job killer. Businesses have to pay higher prices and may not be able to pass them on. So what do? Well, they cut back the largest component of their balance sheet. 90%+ of the time, it's payroll. But more importantly, loose monetary policy over a long period of time tends to lead to asset bubbles. And also severely damages those who can't find a job. Has the Fed truly lost it, ladies and gentlemen? Well, I think you know the answer to that one. I alluded to this earlier. Nearly a million American mothers have left the workforce during the pandemic, and it looks like many of them won't be returning, certainly anytime soon. Women in the U.S. hit a milestone in February 2021 for the first time in history. They held the majority of non-farm payroll jobs, outnumbering men in the workforce. And now, a year later, women's labor force participation is at a 33-year low, putting mothers, many of whom were in the heights of their careers before the pandemic, back to work is vital to the health of the U.S. economy, at least according to the experts. The divide between women's and men's unemployment numbers is driven by the difference between the pandemic experiences of working moms and dads. According to economist Jed Kolko of Indeed, who says, just look at the prime age employment to population ratio. That's the share of people aged 25 to 54 who are employed. Look at how that's changed for different groups of workers. The share of women aged 25 to 54 without kids who are employed has dropped 4.8 percentage points over the course of the pandemic. Drop is the same for men of that age without kids. But when you look at workers of prime age with kids, the drops are 3% for men and closer to 6% for women. In other words, working mothers have fared worse than any other group, well, namely men. Kolko says distance learning and childcare have been huge burdens on parents, especially moms, who've been forced to balance employment and caregiving. There are going to be long tail effects that hurt working women and mothers long after the pandemic is over now. Single mothers, particularly in low-wage jobs, have been forced to quit for childcare and don't have a safety net of savings, are suddenly dealing with food and housing insecurity. On the high end of the wage spectrum, there are a lot of cases of women in office jobs who are turning down promotions. University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevens says, there are a lot of women in that position right now. They're saying, sorry, my kids can't handle this. Wow. Well, I can't handle the fact that we're already at our first break. So stick with us. Listen to these messages, and we'll return in a few. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody. Well, we mentioned Jay Powell, the Fed chair, the first segment. Afraid we're going to start the second one with some more mention of him. I mean, like them or not, two of the world's foremost central bankers reinforced their positions on the potential for damaging inflation in the wake of the pandemic, saying in no uncertain terms that they simply don't see it. That's exactly what former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers warned about in a recent op-ed. That's where he cited the potential for inflationary pressures of a kind, quote, we haven't seen in a generation, with consequences for the value of the dollar and financial stability, unquote. Now, yesterday, European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde said, I don't think we're worrying about reflation, and it's going to be a while before we worry about inflation. If you consider how far we are from our goal, we are very far away. A few hours later, Fed Chair Powell added, as we look forward, we will probably see an increase in inflation readings. That's not going to mean very much, however. It won't be larger or persistent. That was at the same Economic Club of New York that he talked about unemployment at as well. Now, previous central bank leaders were concerned early on with the possibility of inflation creeping higher, and then they'd raise interest rates at the first sign of price pressures. Having examined more than a decade of stubbornly low inflation, as reported by the government, Powell and Lagarde, both the central bank heads in their first term, who neither of whom are trained economists, are turning their backs on the old way. Summers believes the proposed largesse of spending being considered in the $1.9 trillion stimulus package will be manageable if monetary and fiscal policy can be rapidly adjusted to address the problem. But given the commitments the Fed has made, this is Summers still, administration officials' dismissal of even the possibility of inflation has him concerned. The difficulties in mobilizing congressional support for tax increases or spending cuts believes there's the risk of inflation expectations rising sharply. But Powell, Lagarde, and other central bankers that, they've said if inflation does arise, they have the tools necessary to bring it under control and quickly. Given the the choice between raising rates to choke off inflation that would send the country into another recession or deeper into the current one, as this case may be, or letting inflation bubble up but keeping rates low to allow asset prices to continue booming and the job market to strengthen, well, central bankers' comments and actions in recent years have reasonably sowed doubt in critics like Summers that the former path would be pursued over the latter. However, as Summers argues, stimulus measures of the magnitude contemplated are steps into the unknown. This is where he talks about the new stimulus package and saying it's far too large and thus unnecessarily large. For credibility, Summers concludes, they need to be accompanied by clear statements that the consequences will be monitored closely, and if necessary, there will be the capacity and will to adjust policy quickly. Well, for what it's worth, I think that's what Powell and Lagarde are saying. But in any event, some conflict there among the so-called leaders of establishment finance. Hey, it's Thursday. Well, you know what that means. It's time for Levity is Golden, our weekly look at a topic that may or may not be spot on with gold. This week's topic's about empty store shelves. For anyone with a TV, forget about cable, and especially those with children or a sweet tooth. Tony the Tiger, an adorable icon, hero, and yes, some would even say a role model, though one who carries a double-edged sword. And now, thanks to the pandemic, Tony isn't smiling or roaring just as loudly as he has been in the past. Thanks to the pandemic, the Kellogg Company has struggled to keep its bellwether Frosted Flake cereal on store shelves in recent months. The food maker, the packaged food maker, has also been unable to meet demand for its Morningstar meats alternatives, as well as its Corn Flake cereal. Company saying this has reported its fourth quarter results. Now, the supply challenges for some of Kellogg's marquee brands come as many retailers say the pandemic-driven pantry loading trend is beginning to wane. Kellogg acknowledged that it was caught flat-footed by soaring demand for certain foods last year after the pandemic began, after several down years for the cereal. For cereal in general, largely over concern of too much sugar in our bodies, rightly so. Now, the Morningstar Farms challenges take the shine off an otherwise banner year as sales of meat alternatives happen to take off. CEO Steve Callahan said that we weren't planning on growing 25% as we entered the year. That was last year, 2020. He said the demand surge driven by the pandemic was unknowable. Now, while Morningstar Farms has been the leader in the meat substitutes category at retail for years, and its sales were increasing, its market share was still slipping. In 2020, it was knocked from the top spot, in fact, by Beyond Meat. That's according to Euromonitor. But other companies in the booming meat alternative space were better prepared, having ramped up production before and during the pandemic. ConAgra has announced investments to increase Guardian's manufacturing capacity, including $16 million to expand a Maryland plant. Impossible Foods, which has its own shortages, has said it's increased production sixfold at its Oakland plant and an additional capacity at other plants with its manufacturing partners. Now back to the cereal front. Kellogg had to curb promotions of Frosted Flakes due to capacity constraint, and that's led to a decline in market share last quarter. New promotions could be crucial to the success of the cereal empire, as consumers are likely to be influenced by current cereal ads. But Kellogg's brands aren't the only ones that have been harder to find during the pandemic, following a shortage of Grape Nut cereal. Post Holdings said that its product will be shipping at full capacity by mid-March. So sugar-craved Americans, I'm sure, can hardly wait, as well as good old Tony, who going to be happy to come out of hibernation. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Back to the news, more Fed news, in fact. President Biden reportedly is considering Lisa Cook. She's an economist at Michigan State University to fill an open seat on the Federal Reserve Board. Now, that appointment would be historic, since Cook would be become the first black woman to join the Fed's governing board. It also would reveal both the new president's preferences for monetary policy and how he may reconstitute the Fed, including the chairmanship when it's up next year. Jerome Powell's term is up in February 2022, but presidents typically announce a replacement or whether to renominate the chair the summer before the expiration. Now, that, of course, would be this summer, plenty of time, one would think, for financial markets to adjust to any changes. Now, Cook's academic writing suggests she's a dove, meaning she's less concerned about inflation and more focused on improving labor market conditions. Also written about the broader effects of racial bias and how discrimination inflicts a staggering cost on an entire economy. Cook served as a senior economist, Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama, and was a member of Biden's transition team. Biden also going to have an opportunity to nominate a vice chair for supervision when the term of that post current occupant, Randall Quarles, expires this October, and also be able to replace, if he wants, Richard Clarita, the other vice chair, when his term ends next January. Lyle Brainard, a federal Fed governor who Biden considered for Treasury Secretary before deciding on Janet Yellen, could be elevated to either of those positions. Cook could also be elevated to one of them, vice chair or chair, which would require a separate Senate confirmation vote. Interesting development. No more Judy Shelton in any event. So we'll see how those confirmation hearings go, presumably this spring, should she in fact be nominated. Now, interesting development. This came out late yesterday. I don't believe Melody talked about it on the program, but we know that Joe Biden has taken the helm of an economy facing an uneven rebound from the pandemic and the recession that preceded it, and that continues. Steady in some areas like housing, but rocky in others like the labor market. Now, since the November elections, overall consumer sentiment has fallen by about 3 points since Biden's victory. That's according to Bloomberg's Consumer Comfort Index, or CCI, they call it. The overall index includes three gauges of attitudes about the economy, personal finances, and the buying climate. Urging views of the national economy and personal finances are broadening, while sentiment about the buying climate has remained largely steady as interest rates remain low. Now, overall, consumer sentiment, that's fallen 7% since the election, from 48 on November 8th to 40, just shy of 45 on February 7th. The percentage of people happy with their personal finances has fallen since the elections, from 62.7% to 60.1%, although those ratings did rise a little bit last week and have increased 4.5 points in the last 3 weeks. Americans' feelings about the economy are down almost 4 points over the last 2 weeks and are down more slightly since the elections, no doubt reflecting disappointment over the more recent employment reports. Now, feelings are most pessimistic when it comes to the overall economy. Only 34.8% feel good about the economy. It's down almost 12% from 39.4% on November 8th, Election Day. Consumer comfort among Hispanics rose to a five-month high of 40 compared to 35 in November. That compares with 34.6 among Black Americans. That's 5 points off its pandemic high in mid-September, but up 4.6 since November. All of the gains in the overall consumer comfort index have been driven by young people in recent months. Americans age 65 and older have seen the biggest change of any age group, with an 8-point loss in sentiment to 39.5%. Difficulty in getting vaccines may be the culprit there. Now, those who are 18 to 34 comprise the only category who saw an increase since the election and who show the highest sentiment at 49.8. Some interesting trends there. A lot of them, I might say, are intuitive, but a couple of surprises, I guess, as well. Now, another interesting development, one that will surely ramp up debate in Congress in the coming weeks. Democrats' stimulus relief proposals now include major changes to the Affordable Care Act, aiming to make health insurance more affordable for the millions of people who've lost employer-based coverage during the pandemic. And that would equate to those who've lost jobs. The changes would check off a whole lot of moderate Democrats' health care agenda, at least for the time being. The House Ways and Means Committee began considering its portion of the relief package yesterday, the Energy and Commerce Committee following this morning. Now, people making up to 150% of the federal poverty rate would be eligible for fully subsidized plans, that is, premiums paid by the government, regardless of their income. And no one, regardless of their income, would be required to pay more than 8.5% of their adjusted gross income, presumably, for health insurance. People receiving unemployment would also be eligible for full government subsidies for a year. The energy and commerce legislation simply incentivizes, or mainly incentivizes, states that haven't done so to expand Medicaid. Now, health strategist Chris Jennings says this is the first real significant down payment that the industry's been able to secure since the policies, that is, the ACA's initial enactment. A large coalition of insurers, employers, hospitals, and doctors, groups that often butt heads, happen to support, or said anyway, to support many of the components of this proposal. But noticeably absent from all of this are policies that would actually reduce the actual cost of health care for those covered. Increasing subsidies just means that the government would shoulder more of the burden while the U.S.'s extraordinarily high prices go untouched, at least through this legislation. Of course, any attempt to control the cost of care further would quickly erode a lot of the support from the health care industry. Kaiser Family Foundation's Larry Levitt said, "These subsidy enhancements, along with a new outreach campaign that reverses the 90% cut last administration, has the potential to supercharge the upcoming enrollment period. We shall see. For another break, stay with us. Back in a few, you're listening.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back to Financial Survival. Let's see, what shall we talk about this last segment? Most of the time, it's impossible to tell the future. I mean, everyone tries their best when it comes to forecasting, estimating, what have you. But it's a tough and sort of unforgiving game, or art, I should say. But there are exceptions, sort of like today. One thing we do know for sure is that the U.S. and the rest of the world is going to try and spend its way out of the pandemic crisis. Probably because we have to. Unless we want to see all sorts of widespread devastation continue. It's just how we do it we've got to be careful about. But this crystal ball is becoming clearer and clearer. We know that Wall Street's been looking into it. That's why stocks are near all-time highs. Again, it's why increasingly the savviest managers, particularly in the paper markets, are also catching on and acting. Why Tesla just moved $1.5 billion of its cash into Bitcoin and an unspecified amount into gold. In fact, here's what Tesla's latest 10K filing said. In January 2021, we've updated our investment policy to invest in a portion of cash in certain, quote, alternative reserve assets, including digital assets, gold bullion, gold exchange traded funds, and other assets as may be specified in the future. Folks, the writing's on the wall. Corporate America is cluing in, but the vast majority of individual investors still haven't, at least yet. It's why gold, silver, and pretty much all commodities have started to run higher again. In short, the dollar is toast. Now, the dollar has been the undisputed reserve currency around the world for nearly a century. But coincidentally, that's the average lifespan of a reserve currency going back over 500 years. The dollar enjoyed a short reprieve over the last decade or so, but central bank and government reaction worldwide to the pandemic was the final straw. And the camel's back is now broken. The dollar as a percentage of the world foreign exchange reserves has fallen steadily since early 2015. That's when it was 66%. Today, it's closer to 61%. That's a drop of close to 10%. The action in the U.S. dollar index over the past few years tells a similar story. The dollar is clearly broken down. It's below a rising trend line after peaking near 105 last March. Today, it's trading right around 90. By all accounts, the dollar has resumed its long-term downtrend. At the same time, almost all analysts now expect gold output to grow over the next decade. A report by Fitch Solutions forecasts about 2.5% annual gold production growth between now and 2029, led mainly by Russia, which would overtake China as the largest producer by then. But it's worth noting that Russia's drive to gold, to grow its gold output is in order to increase its central bank holdings as a buffer against ongoing U.S. sanctions, and also risks of Russian banks being excluded from dealing in dollar-denominated assets. So a lot of Russia's production may never reach market. Going all the way back to the mid-70s, the price of gold's not only kept pace with, but it surpassed global M2 money supply growth. And according to the World Gold Council, central banks are set to remain net buyers again this year. Financial and geopolitical uncertainty, near zero or in some cases negative interest rates, historic levels of fiscal and monetary stimulus, and massive pent-up demand as pandemic effects subside mean gold is primed to outperform not just itself, but most, if not all, other asset classes, as it did last year with its 25% return. Silver obviously did even better. Now, the dollar has resumed its long-term downtrend as investors begin to realize it's about to be printed into oblivion. So you need to take steps now that will help you protect your cash and purchasing power. And that means prioritizing precious metals when it comes to using any excess cash and income you have to expand your investment portfolio. Hey, it's not just us saying gold's a necessary reserve asset. I mean, today, even Elon Musk likes gold. What more do you want? Call us, 1-800-375-4188. Now, we've touched on this next topic before, but more detailed numbers are coming out, and they show that nearly 9 million Americans moved last year during the midst of a pandemic. And a lot of them actually ended up settling, as we mentioned before, in Idaho. Moving contracts from Atlas Van Line show that of the people who settled in a new state during the pandemic, many have opted for a suburb or an area with more space over a popular but more expensive and dense big city. Now, the researchers analyzed just about 65,000 interstate and international moves to identify what they call inbound versus outbound states. Inbound states, they're where of the total number of people who moved, more moved in rather than away. Outbound states are the opposite. A larger share of total movers left the state rather than stayed. Now, Warburg Realty real estate agent Steve Gottlieb observed that living through a pandemic with everyone working and learning on top of one another at home just might have pushed them. You think? Idaho claimed the top spot on Atlas's inbound list for the fourth time since 2016. Of all the moves to or from the state from January to December last year, two-thirds were people moving in. People also moved to North Carolina, Maine, and New Hampshire in droves. Those states saw incomers at roughly 61 to 64%. Alabama, New Mexico, and Alaska each pulled in new residents at a rate of just a little less, at 60%. Now, more people moved into than out of Kentucky for the first time in a decade. Don't know if that was the vote for Mitch McConnell, sent him back to the U.S. Senate. California, on the other hand, set a different record. A total of 57% of its moves were people leaving the state in 2020. Last year, in fact, was the first time the Gold State was classified as an outbound state since 1995. The overall moving trend has leaned towards suburbs since they could be less dense and less expensive and offer larger homes and generally more land. Houses with space are particularly useful in the current crisis, since at least 40% of the American workforce was said to be fully remote as of December. And over 70% of home buyers and sellers expect they'll be able to keep doing work from home. Now, Williamson County in Texas, that's a suburb near Austin, had the largest inbound gains in the first 7 months of the pandemic. Almost 4,000 more people moved in than out. Suffolk County, New York, another suburb, also saw a fresh influx. In contrast, New York County, essentially Manhattan, and Texas's Travis, Harris, and Dallas counties, that's where Austin, Houston, and Dallas are, lost over 25,000 movers. I believe that's combined. Now, many of the people who moved last year didn't go very far. More than half of those who fled New York settled next door in New Jersey, and 12% went the other way to Connecticut. And most San Franciscans who relocated moved within 60 miles of their old address. The 8.93 million Americans who moved at the beginning of the pandemic is an increase of about 94,000 people who relocated during the same period the year before, 2019. On a separate but similar story, it's no wonder so many people and businesses are moving. Of the 50 most expensive places to rent office space, 29 of them are in California, and 13 are in New York, with the Bay Area, Manhattan, and Brooklyn dominating that list. And despite predictions of pandemic-related shakeups in commercial real estate and the fact that so many cubicle dwellers are now working at home, desirable office urban space remains at a premium. A ranking based on fourth quarter numbers was topped by Menlo Park, California. That's home to Facebook headquarters and the so-called Plaza District of Midtown Manhattan. Only five states, California, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, and Florida, plus the District of Columbia, were represented on this, we'll call it infamous list. The most expensive place that was not in New York or California, standing at number 15 overall, Cambridge, Massachusetts, home to Harvard University, of course, but also a number of high-rent office parks. Downtown Boston is number 31. The NoMa area of D.C., that's north of Massachusetts Avenue, was 35. East Austin, state capital in Texas, was 40. Downtown Austin, 46. Miami's Brickell District, 50. The data, which include only space of 25,000 square feet or more, represents the asking rents for offices, not necessarily those paid. Now, Moody's analytics predicts that effective office rents in the Silicon Valley and New York will actually plummet this year, despite only dropping about 0.7% in 2020. They also believe the vacancy rate will rise to an alarming 19%+ this year, surpassing the previous high of 17.6% in 2010. Moody said the average effective office rent is projected to decline by 7.5% this year before leveling out in 2022. We don't expect average effective office rents to reach their pre-pandemic levels until 2026. All right, we're winding down here. Let's just talk about North Korea briefly. It's modernized its nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles by flaunting UN sanctions. And now it's reportedly using cyber attacks to help finance its nuclear programs and continuing to seek material and technologies overseas for its arsenal. That's according to the UN. A panel of experts monitoring sanctions on the nation said in a report sent to Security Council members that the North's theft of virtual assets from 2019 through November 2020 is valued at $316.4 million. The investigations found that North Korean-linked cyber actors continue to conduct operations against financial institutions and virtual currency exchange houses to generate money to support its weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile-building programs. In its weapons development, the experts said, Kim Jong-un's government has also produced fissile material that, of course, is the essential ingredient for producing nuclear weapons to maintain its facilities. Well, on that grim note, we're going to call it a day. It's been fun for me. I hope it's been informative for you. Tomorrow's another day. Melody, you'll be back with Pastor Butch. In the meantime, I hope you'll be looking out for my weekly blog in your email inboxes tomorrow morning. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks a lot for listening. Have a great night. Bye.